So the title of my talk is from cool CGC, however you may prefer to call CGC, to a hot QGP. Let me sort of briefly mention my collaborators. Alex Krasnitz, Yasushi Nara, who's a postdoc at the Riken BNL Center, and Bhima Karzai, And Bhima Karzai, as I mentioned, with whom we have collaborated on the topic of topological charge fluctuations and heavy ion collisions, and I won't be talking about that work here due to a limited amount of time. So the outline of my talk, since Alex talked about small x physics, I won't give a very detailed introduction. And then I'll sort of move on to describe a classical approach to nuclear collisions at very high energies, how one could sort of, within a classical approach, sort of formulate a self-consistent picture to describe the very initial instance of heavy ion collision. And this involves computing all possible tree-level graphs in this classical approach, and it's virtually impossible to do it analytically, but it can be done numerically, and that's what I'll tell you about. And then I'll sort of briefly talk about the late stages, thermalization, hydrodynamics, and so on. And with regard to the Rick data, since there's been much discussion of Dima's nice work, I'll sort of just restrict myself to talking about one particular variable, which is V2. And I'll end with an outlook. So the first thing I'd like to sort of reiterate to emphasize its importance is that the physics of multiparticle production at very high energies is small x physics. So if you really want to understand multiparticle production, you have to understand what happens in the small x part of the wave function. Now, one way to sort of see this in a very simple but not simple-minded fashion, as was sort of very clearly enunciated by these three guys a long time ago, is that you can sort of write the wave function of whatever object, projectile, your nucleus, if you like, as sort of a linear combination of these various Fock states that you can have. So in a nucleus, you have 3A quarks and 3A quarks and a gluon and so on. Now, at very low energies, you don't really sort of probe these components of the wave function, and so they don't really matter. But as you go to very high energies, these components become very large. Where you have a large number of gluons, these components with very large numbers of gluons and QQ bars and so on become very important. And so you can just sort of see from this that if you have a large number of these objects in your Fock state, each of these must, by necessity, carry a very small part of the momentum. So that's a fraction x of the nuclear momentum. And so if you want to describe multiparticle production, you can sort of focus on these Fock components and try and construct a theory for these Fock components and pay less attention to the others. That's called an effective field theory. It's sort of motivated by the fact that if you look at your particle data book, most of the valence quarks sort of seem lumped at large values of x, while the gluon distributions, as we've learned from a couple of decades of experiments, seem to rise very rapidly, and the C quarks also seem to tag along with the gluons. So if you construct a theory for this, and you're interested in these components of the wave function, you can treat the large x components as sources and sort of write down a theory for this. And that's what this sort of action sort of symbolizes. You have an integral over these sources, which I call rho, and also over the dynamical fields is a path integral. And this is your action, which is a function of both A and rho. And so that contains a term which is f mu nu squared. That's the sort of dynamical, which describes the dynamical degrees for here, the gluons. And then there's a coupling between the sources here and the dynamical fields, which I represent this in this form. That's familiar to many of you. And then you have sort of a weight, which denotes the importance of sort of different configurations of these sources. I'm describing these dynamical degrees of freedom. And if you have a large nucleus, you can sort of make a simple model that this is a Gaussian expression with some weight, which is a dimension full scale that's a color chart squared per unit area. Now, the other thing is that if you're trying to, if you're working at very high energies, then only one component of this source term is important. All the other terms are being suppressed by powers of the momentum. So then you have only these static light cone sources, and that can be represented in this form where the source is a delta function on the light cone in the direction of the moving nucleus. And then you have some charge density which you sort of integrate over for different configurations. Now, there's a much more sophisticated version of this sort of effective field theory, and this is in part what Alex talked about. And sort of these are the authors who go under this acronym here. This is Julian Murray and Ian Koo, McLaren, Weigert, Leonard, Kovner. And Kovner is the guy you heard from.
Is that what you call PDK?
I guess so. So if you sort of talk about asymptotics, now if you're at very, very high energies, then you expect the scale lambda s squared to be much larger than lambda squared QCD, and this is sort of the justification of trying to use weak coupling methods. So your coupling, which you run as a function of the scale and the effective action, and that would be small. Now, in real life, is that true? And I'll talk a little bit more about this later. I'll come back to it. But one can sort of roughly estimate it's between 1 to 2 GV² at RIC. To really sort of know this better, you have to understand what the gluon distribution is like inside a nucleus. And we really don't have much of a clue of what that is. So there's a tremendous uncertainty due to that. Now, in this classical approach, you can sort of ask the question, what does the wave function look like for these modes? And you can actually analytically compute it in this effective theory. And this is what it looks like. This is a distribution as a function of momentum. At very large momentum, it has this white circle Williams form, which goes as 1 over kT², all be weighted by this color charge squared. However, if you are in a regime where there's clean separation between lambda QCD and the scale here, then you have a complete resummation to all orders in this ratio here, and the distribution qualitatively changes to a logarithmic behavior. So it sort of tames this 1 over k² rise. Now, of course, for that to be true, you have to have a clean sort of separation between the truly intrinsically non-perturbative regime and this, where this, you have the scale lambda s. So another way of phrasing it is that if you look at the typical momentum of where these guys lie, you say most of the gluons sort of have momentum the order kT. Now, again, if the occupation number is very small, if the coupling is very small, the occupation number is large, and this sort of classical approach can be applied to understand nuclear collisions. Now, if you want to understand nuclear collisions or collisions at very high energy in general, you have to keep in mind that the sort of quantum mechanical coherence of the problem, that is the typical wavelength of a parton in your incoming nucleus, goes as 1 over x, roughly. And at small x, this is large. Okay, so in other words, if you take a typical example, if x is about 10 raised to minus 2, the partons from the incoming nucleus will see simultaneously several partons from your target nucleus. So really, they're not suffering binary scatterings, but they're simultaneously scattering with several of these guys all at once. And then this sort of collinear factorized picture is problematic. We don't know exactly where it breaks down, but in principle, it's problematic at small x. And so you cannot write this jet cross section as a simple convolution of probabilities, but you have to take into effect the influence of coherence. So you have to describe the physics more at the level of amplitudes rather than that of probabilities. Now, that's a difficult problem, but there you're helped by the fact that if you have a large scale, then you can use classical methods to describe these nuclear collisions. So to put that in sort of a cartoon form, I would say that in these two incoming nuclei, there's a scale, which I call lambda s, And I argued to you that if you look at the classical distribution of partons, this scale sort of dominates how the distribution looks like. And it's the only scalar problem besides the size of the nucleus. So that's very same scale should also describe the initial multiplicity and transverse energy of produced gluons within this approach. Okay, so that's a sort of simple minor idea that one has. So one could start off with a simple model of trying to sort of describe these nuclear collisions. You can make sort of controlled improvements of this model, but for the moment I'm going to stick to this sort of relatively simple model here, where I consider these two incoming nuclei from the different sort of meeting at this point here, which I call t equal to zero, and the evolution of the partons in the nucleus in the collision are determined by the initial conditions of the two nuclei on the light cone here. But this is what I claim to you that one can compute sort of analytically in this classical field approach, so you know what they are. So if you know the initial conditions, you can sort of determine the evolution classically by solving the Yang-Mills equations for the two nuclei. These are the classical non-Abelian equations of motion in the presence of these two sort of light cone sources. So this is the sort of charge density due to the valence partons in one light cone. This is the charge density due to the valence partons in the other light cone. And they are sort of this, they're denoted by these random charge distributions, rho 1 and rho 2. Ultimately, if you want to compute physical observables, you have to sort of average over these different configurations. So you know, each rho would correspond to, say, a single event in a nuclear collision, and you're sort of averaging over all such events. And this is where the scale lambda s comes in to play in this simple formulation of the problem. Now, in this classical approach, what that corresponds to is that you're computing all tree-level graphs. Okay, so you're computing all such diagrams of this sort here, which include things that look like sort of multiple state scattering. And this is a very difficult problem to solve analytically. You have a huge number of such graphs. However, you can compute all these graphs numerically, and that's what sort of Alex Krasnitz and I sort of started to do. You're helped by the fact that you really have only two parameters in the problem in this sort of simple formulation, with the scale lambda s and r. And as I argue to you, this has some range 1 to 2 GeV at Rick energies, and r is about 6.5 Fermi, so you get some sort of range for sort of all such dimensionless combinations. The size of this combination here determines the size of the nonlinearities in your Yang-Mills equations. So the larger the size, the stronger the nonlinearities that you expect at the initial stages. So since it's a gauge theory, it's convenient to formulate this numerical problem in a lattice. And so you can write down the lattice Hamiltonian in this A tau equal to zero gauge. This is what's called, often called the Fock-Schwinger or radiation gauge. It's an interpolation between two light cone gauges. And this is a form of the Hamiltonian that one has in general in 3 plus 1 dimensions. Now, if you consider only boost invariant configurations, which would be valid if you really have pancakes, you know, delta function sources, then you get sort of a dimensional reduction, which sort of resembles the kind of dimensional reduction that Kao talked about a couple of days ago. You can sort of write down sort of a reduced form of this Hamiltonian in terms of adjoint fields, scalar fields as well. Then you can go ahead and discretize this Hamiltonian on a lattice. The dynamics is 2 plus 1 dimensional, so it simplifies your problem. However, there's no problem in principle in solving the full thing, and it's just a little more numerically involved, but we are actually contemplating doing that right now. So then the sort of algorithm is you sort of to study the real-time gluon dynamics, that you solve this 2 plus 1d classical Hamiltonian, specifically you solve Hamilton's equations as a function of proper time, and you can then study the space-time evolution of gauge fields at eta equal to zero. So let me now come to some results from this approach. So you can ask the question about what is the formation time in these gluons. So if you Here on the y-axis, I plot the energy density times the proper time in scaled units of lambda s versus time, in scaled units. And if I choose lambda s of 2 GeV, say, then these correspond to these times here for Rick. And you can see that you sort of initially produce a lot of gluons, and then this sort of saturates at some later times. This is sort of highly non-trivial, sort of non-invariant transient behavior. I mean, these early times, you can't really talk about partons. These are sort of strongly interacting fields. So it's.
When can you start talking about partons?
Okay, so that's my next set. But before that, let me sort of digress briefly and sort of argue a little bit more about what might be the property values of lambda to choose. So from Hera, you have this very nice parameterization due to Golic, Bernard, and Wusthof, where they parameterize all the Hera data for x less than 10 raised to minus 2 with this form here. For Rick, one expects that you have, in some sort of tube in the longitudinal direction, you expect about 8 to the 1/3 such nucleons. So this is the value of lambda s squared one would naively get. And if you solve this equation self-consistently, you get about 1.4 GV for Rick and 2.2 GV for LHC energies. And this is also roughly what Dima obtained and what he was doing. Even though I don't recall if his LHC value was the same. Now if you sort of say, well, what is the formation time? What you can do is you can sort of fit this transient form to something, to an expression like this, where this is the final asymptotic value at which you can really define an energy. And the scale controlling that is this what I call the formation time here. I mean, that's how one sort of within this formalism defines a formation time gluons. And you can actually compute that, and this is fairly robust. And that goes as 1 over lambda s, as you would expect. So what we really compute is this number. And you can extract what the transverse energy is at initial times. So for these values of lambda s that I mentioned, you get at Rick about 0.4, plus minus a theoretical systematic error about 10%. At LHC, you get something like 0.5. But keep in mind that all these numbers are highly sensitive to what your precise value of lambda s is. It can change. The important thing is you can derive sort of non-perturbative formula of that sort. And so here's another non-perturbative formula you derive from that earlier expression. You can compute this coefficient, again, non-perturbatively. And for a wide range of energies, it has a very slow variation, and sort of within 10% or so. And then for these values of lambda s, you can extract what you expect the initial transient energy to produce gluons, when you can really start talking of things as gluons, at Rick. And that's about 1.1 TeV and 4.4 for LHC. So now you can sort of go ahead and try and compute what the number is. And in a gauge theory, it's always sort of problematic, and especially non-abelian gauge theories, to try and define what a number is of partons. But we sort of devised two different methods. One is you can sort of fix a Coulomb gauge and extract what the gluon number is. You can sort of linearize the fields and compute the gluon number. You can extract a dispersion relation. And the other is to use a sort of gauge invariant Coulomb method, whereby you can measure the total number as a gauge invariant object, even though you can't compute the number distribution this way. But you can sort of compare the two methods and see if the two agree. So in a similar fashion, you can compute the initial multiplicity distributions of produced gluons. And again, you have this non-perturbative coefficient you compute in the lattice. It's, again, very robust in a wide range of this value here, this non-perturbative scale here. And for Rick, for these values, you get something which is about half the multiplicity of finally produced hadrons. But I should remark that this is the number of gluons that you have initially. It's not the final number of hadrons that you have. And between this point and that final point is a big step. Now, you can also derive a formula for the energy density in this fashion. This is again what we estimate on this lattice. At this time, tau equal to tau f, and at RIC you find a number that's about 20 GeV per Fermi squared. At LHC you find it's 120 GeV per Fermi squared. But you know, keep in mind, again, it's highly sensitive to what lambda s is. You change it by 10%, you get a huge difference, right?
Fermi cube, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's fine.
Right.
And your, the fact that it's the ND eta is 500 and DET eta was about the G was 1,000 GeV.
Right.
Each gluon is at 2 GeV at this point?
Each gluon, well, the typical PT, right, right, exactly.
On the average.
Right, right, on the average. So you can also compute the differential sort of number distributions for, again, different values of this non-perturbative scale. And you see that sort of remarkably, the distribution is well fit by sort of a Bose-Einstein-like form for small values of KT, less KT over lambda less than 3. So at RIC, this would be about 4 to 5 GeV. And then you have a power law tail, which goes as 1 over KT to the 4th at large values of KT. Sort of remarkable that you can sort of do a classical field theory and you obtain something that seems to look like an exponential at small momenta. So to sort of summarize my view, which sort of is very similar to that sort of articulated by Beyer, Mueller, Schiff, and so on. It's actually their view, and I agree with sort of them in principle, is that at the initial point here, so this is your time axis again in this sort of dimensionless variable here. So the nuclei collide here at t equal to 0. And initially, you have sort of very strongly interacting sort of nonlinear classical fields. You can't even talk about particles at these very early times. And then at some time, which is roughly 1 over QS, these fields linearize. And the gluons have some typical momentum, which is sort of the order QS or lambda S. And then they've sort of, once they're sort of formed in this transverse plane, so you're sitting at y equal to 0, and then once they sort of form this transverse plane, they begin to sort of scatter among each other. And between this time scale, these time scales here, the occupation number becomes small. The system is expanding, of course, so the occupation number will fall, and this classical approach will break down. Okay, you can't really use these sort of numerical classical description to accurately describe the physics here. Okay, and so you have to sort of resort to some other techniques, but the physics as envisaged by these guys here is that you have in this time scale you have sort of soft gluons which are radiated initially, sort of begin to screen the hard emission, the further emission of soft gluons by the hard guys, and the LPM effect is very important in this regime here. So it's not clear that you can really use a simple cascade type description here either. And then between this time here, time scales here, the soft gluons thermalize, but there's still a few hard gluons which are sort of adding energy to the bath. But finally, they also sort of deplete all the energy in the system, thermalizes at this time here. And then the further evolution is a highly viscous, very non-ideal, possibly a non-adiabatic hydrodynamics, which it's not clear is even mechanically stable, but that's right.
When on that picture did you, is where you had 500 gluons with 2 GeV, where at time one, time there?
Right. Now I should say that I don't have all the physics of this thing here, because I have a 2 plus 1 dimensional sort of transverse plane, and a lot of that scattering is really off the plane. Okay, so in principle, to correctly include that, which I can, is to sort of give some width and rapidity, and that will sort of actually interestingly change change our results at this time here.
As you go from there up to the final where hydro starts working,
Right, if it starts working, right. Right.
Well, as you go to your 1 over alpha to the 13th,
right.
What happens to the gluon number and the mean gluon energy?
Right, so this is, this is what, this I'm repeating their estimate, which is, I should emphasize, it's really for asymptotically small values of alpha s. that goes as 1 over, so it's 1 over alpha s to the 7/5 times a number which they haven't computed. Okay, it's hard for them to compute. So the number definitely increases, but how much it increases by, and where's Rolf Meyer can tell us more about this, how big this number is really is depends on calculation, which is very important to do, as Uli Hines emphasized also yesterday. So that really sort of gives you the multiplication factor of gluons at later times. And the energy you can sort of compute, the typical energy of a gluon you can compute from the temperature. So we've gone beyond sort of all these results that I'm reporting were with periodic boundary conditions. You can sort of go to open boundary conditions. And then when you're sort of describing finite nuclei, you have this problem that Alex also talked about where, you know, you have gluon fields sort of expanding outside the regime of your interaction. And you can sort of impose color neutrality as was discussed by Lam and Malin. So let me just go now to discuss elliptic flow directly. So as you've sort of heard, ad infinitum or ad nauseum is depending on your persuasion. V2 is defined as the average or second Fourier coefficient. And so that can be sort of written as this integral over the number distributions, so the azimuthal number distribution. And this can, you know, we can actually directly compute this. That's relatively straightforward. So what that involves is really studying different components of the stress energy tensor as a function of time. And so here I plotted what the behavior is. So here's TXX and TYY separately. And TXX plus TYY at late times agrees with the energy as you would expect, like if you had free streaming in the transverse plane. However, TXX and TYY don't agree with each other, which is what is the source of this anisotropy that you define as, interpret as elliptic flow. So here's a plot of this TXX minus TYY or TXX plus TYY as a function of time normalized by the size of your interaction region. And you can see it sort of grows over some time which is comparable to that size. It's not very early times. Now, I gave some talks previously very early on where you saw some sort of a transient peak. And the source of the transient peak had to do with color neutrality. It was a very subtle thing that took us a long time to understand. But you really get something like this at the end. Now, this turns out, unlike hydro, it turns out to be a lower limit on our elliptic flow. Because in hydro, the momentum goes up at high PT, while in our case, it goes down. So this in hydro, this is an upper limit, while in our case, it's a lower limit.
What V2 is this?
This is not V2. This is just this quantity here. So you can... you can sort of, it's closely related to, but it's not V2. Sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. The red is for a large value of the coupling. So this is, for example, much larger than the Rick value. So this would be more like LSC kind of regime, while this would be sort of smaller than the Rick value. So it sort of lies in between.
Yeah. So
I have very little time, sir.
Right. So the time on which this is happening is of order the size of the nucleus, or the size of the omen, the size of the omen.
Right, it's about, right.
But your initial description, was only valid for the first...
That's right. I'll sort of come back to this later.
So you can really only trust this for the very, very last...
Let me come back to this point later.
Okay.
So if I now compute V2, right, then V2 from a certain method, a cooling method, at a certain number of time steps, you know, which is not a very long time, looks like this for different values. And this is sort of the preliminary star data. And, you know, you get something that's sort of comparable, okay, to what you have. However, this was really from a, and we had this result, you know, three months ago, okay, or maybe even longer. But we had two different ways of trying to compute it to really see if this was robust. So one was from this cooling method, the other is fixing Coulomb gauge. And at the times that we looked at, sort of the relatively early times, we saw that there was a factor of 2 difference between this cooling method and Coulomb gauge, which really puzzled us. And it took us about 3 months to figure this out. And the point is there are lots of technical things you have to sort of correct for. But in the end, you really see that you have to wait for very late times for them, these two methods to agree with each other. Okay, and that's the very late times at which the fields truly linearize in the problem. So if I look at the corrected values at asymptotic times, I get something considerably smaller. So this is, this band sort of represents our theoretical systematic error. I mean, we are like experimentalists, we have sort of finite resources. And so there's some sort of systematic error, and this reflects, smaller than the data for particular values of this lambda s. Okay. Now, to ask what the PT distributions are, you see that they are highly peaked at very soft momenta, even at very late times. And this is a source of the reason why the Coulomb gauge and the cooling methods didn't agree, because both of them assume linearity of gauge fields at late times. And what you're seeing is that even at very late times, it's very soft modes which determine V2. That's not true of the number or the energy density or so on, which is fine, but when you talk about V2, you see that it's really very, very soft non-perturbative fields which carry this sort of, and you get a very large number. But this, of course, as is obvious to most people who know about this stuff, doesn't agree with either the shape or the magnitude of the RIC data. But I emphasize this is the result from very early times. Now we can also go ahead and this is, we compute V2 in our sort of theoretical experiment. We know what the reaction plane is, but you know, in reality, in the experiments, you don't know what this is. So we can sort of also try and do the same thing and mimic what they do, which is sort of measure the two particle cumulants. And we find these are preliminary results. We find that they sort of strongly disagree with just V2 squared. And what that's saying is that event by event fluctuations in our calculation are large. So V2 average, V2 squared average is not the same thing as V2 average squared. And so this can be looked at sort of directly in the experiments, and Sergey Voloshin is sort of trying to do that. Okay, I'm almost done. And there's also very interesting recent work by Kovchegov and Tuchin, which a lot of people are eager to dismiss, where they claim that sort of non-flow corrections explain the high PT behavior of V2. A possible sort of weak link of this work is that they might get a much smaller contribution to the four-particle cumulant than seen in the 2B published star data. But again, that's a calculation that needs to be performed. So I think judgments are premature at this point. And also I should mention that the four-particle cumulants may possibly have some non-flow bias in the experiments. And we are sort of having lots of interesting, exciting discussions with these guys here, if I should acknowledge. So on the theoretical fronts, there are many improvements. This Gaussian model, obviously, is unsatisfactory. But that's actually pretty straightforward to take care of once you know what the right renormalization group weight is. We can treat rapidity dependence and so on. There are other sort of improvements one can make in this numerical framework. But thermalization still remains a mystery because, you know, the classical approach breaks down well before thermalization actually takes place. So really, to compute the final multiplicity of gluons before you sort of start talking about charged particles, that's still something that needs to be resolved. And I think it's a very interesting problem, which I hope lots of people will work on.
Yeah, when you calculate observables which depend on pressure, like V2, I did not quite understand whether or not in your approach the expanding system expands against a real vacuum, a QCD vacuum, or against nothing. I mean, is there a back constant or something which you expand to? And if not, how can you calculate quantities like V2 and expect that they agree with experiments?
Right. So My answer to that is that what we are computing is really the classical equations of QCD, right? I mean, it's the non-abelian classical equations of QCD. Now, this, of course, doesn't include all the effects of confinement because that's a quantum phenomenon, but presumably includes some of the fact because it's, you know, highly non-abelian, highly strongly interacting at large distances. So clearly, we don't include all the right confinement physics, but hopefully we include some of it. But
yeah, but if you
right, that's right. If recoupling is sort of reasonable, then it's you know, it doesn't matter. It's only, I mean, the back constant becomes sort of really sort of important when you're sort of trying to describe some stuff near TC. I'm talking about stuff, well,
yeah, but this,
no.
V2 integrates over everything until TC, so.
But I'm only talking about V2 from early times, so I can't talk about V2 at late times. Okay. Yeah.
I continue to be puzzled by the time dependence of the energy density. I mean, you showed that you have initial multiplicities which are a factor of 2 below what you need at the end, so you have to multiply your gluons by a factor of 2. You have an initial ET which is above the measured value by a factor of 2, so that has to be reduced. The ET per particle has to be reduced by a factor of 4, but your energy density after a strong interaction phase goes like 1 over tau, which is free streaming, no interactions whatsoever. So how can you have a non-interacting behavior of the energy density and at the same time generate V2, multiply gluons, get rid of ET by pushing it into the longitudinal direction? It's a puzzle to me.
Okay, so let me answer this question. So first of all, let me point out that, you know, all these results that I derived, they depend very sensitively on what the value is of this lambda s, which depends on the gluon density. It's quadratically sensitive to the scale. So I can, of course, dial that a little bit further if I want to fit the data. In fact, Alex and I actually made a prediction of the RIC data before the data, and we got it right. And I think it's really like, you know, monkeys sort of predicting the stock exchange. I mean, that, so you can, because it's so sensitive to this fact. The other thing is that I emphasized, you know, this picture of bottom-up thermalization, which I don't. See if I can find this plot here. Okay. Anyway, so the picture is that, is as articulated by Beyer, Mueller, Son, Schiff, is that at very early times, of course, you have very nonlinear classical fields, and all this dynamics is in the transverse plane. Okay. So at some time, which is one over QS, these things become liberated. Right, and then they appear to free stream but then these gluons start to scatter off each other. Okay, that dynamics is not included in this classical formalism. It's not included correctly. Well, the V2 comes from the dynamics of these very soft modes, which are very strongly interacting. In fact, you can see that these actually don't linearize. Right? I mean, you can't even sort of think of these as linear modes. So these soft modes may persist until very late times. You can't even think of these as gluons.
Can you find the transparency in which you had the growth of...
Okay, I want to answer one more point in Uli's comment.
Sure.
Which is, as I repeatedly emphasized, this is the initial number distribution of gluons and initial transverse energy. Of course, you expect the initial transverse is, and the initial transverse energy is not a conserved quantity. The fact that it's a factor of 2 above, I mean, you expect it to be larger. If it were smaller than the measured, you would worry. So of course, you expect it to be larger. The other thing, as I pointed out, there's a big gap between where the classical approach stops and where the system thermalizes, where you start producing particles. Okay, you have 2 GeV gluons sitting there, they're going to radiate. Okay, and so these guys are going to increase the multiplicity and they're going to shift things into soft modes. So thereby that will also lower ET.
Yeah.
Right.
Can you find the transparency where you had the growth of the asymmetry as a function of time measured in units of capital R? Green and red.
Right.
So, your classical treatment stops working at a time of order alpha S to an appropriate power times Q saturation.
Right.
And if I just call that one Fermi, it may be a little more, maybe a little less. Let me just call it one Fermi.
Right, right.
Then in these units, that's somewhere around 0.2, let's say. Again, rough numbers. And so at 0.2, the asymmetry, you know, which is when you have to stop your calculation. And at 0.2, the asymmetry here is of order a quarter of its saturated value, which you get at late times in the calculation. And so my question is, when you showed a plot of V2 versus data with your green theorist's error bar, was that for the asymmetry as saturated or for the asymmetry at time 0.2 in these units?
Okay. So first of all, let me say that this is TXX minus TYY over TXXS plus TYY, which I argued that for our case corresponds to a lower bound in V2. So it's not V2 per se. Now, the point.
I'm just asking, at what time did you use this?
Right. This is at very late times. Okay. So this is a sort of at the asymptotic, so-called asymptotic times that we use in our calculation. But the point, the answer to your question is that now for most quantities, when you talk about occupation number being small or large, you're talking about the average occupation number. However, if you talk about V2 in particular, it turns out that most of the contribution is coming from extremely soft modes. Okay, so these soft modes persist to very late times. That's what this calculation tells us. I mean, you sort of linearize the theory, and you know your soft modes are not linear. They're highly nonlinear even at late times. So you can't really think of these modes as gluons. So all your V2 is coming from modes which are sort of strongly self-interacting classical fields, which you can't think about gluons even at late times.
Sure, but I'm just saying you told us that your calculation is supposed to stop at a certain time.
Right.
And to calculate V2, you've extended it long before when you told us what you had to stop.
Right, but you know that's a statement about distributions on the average, when the occupation number on the average falls below 1. So all of, for example, shifts, zones, buyers, and so on analysis, it's sort of a parametric analysis, which is sort of saying on the average, you expect the occupation number of modes to fall below 1 when the time is 1 over alpha s to the 3/2. However, the point I'm making is that this is sort of the proof of the pudding, is that when you try and linearize the fields at late times, they're not linear. Okay, so they're strongly self-interacting at late times. When if were really the occupation number were truly very small, these soft modes, you know, you'd have a linear theory.
Okay, can we ask you to calculate V2 at the time 0.2 it'll be much smaller, at least smaller by a factor of 4.
It would not be a reliable calculation because I couldn't, V2, remember, how is it defined? It's sort of defined in terms of the number distribution, right? So if I try and define the number distribution at that time, it's not defined. So these two calculations would vastly agree. Which one would you believe?
It seems to me that what you're saying is that it's a bit
old. Right. So I agree with you that V2 is small in this approach. No problem.
Are you saying that the time over which your calculation is applicable is a function of what it is you're calculating?
Absolutely.
And for some things, it's applicable for longer.
You
That's
got it.
The point.
Okay. You got it. Right. Okay.
Sorry.
Right. Roger, let me ask the question in a somewhat different way. And it's not to the diminish your the validity of your calculation, but to try to assess the validity of and the usefulness of that calculation. Obviously, the classical phase during which the equations that you use and solve are valid is limited to a very early period of the collision, even before thermalization.
Right.
So the question then would be, which quantities do you believe, are predominantly determined during that phase and can therefore be quantitatively predicted by your calculation?
That's a very good question. So I would think that most of the observables that I talked about do not fall into that category because there's a lot of physics going on after the classical approximation breaks down. However, I think if you look at things like hard probes, like heavy quark production, for instance, which are very perhaps insensitive to later times, those would be the most sensitive to the earlier stage of the calculation. First of all, the production of heavy quarks would be enhanced because you have this large scale in the problem. Plus, they would interact less with the system at later times, the calculation. So you might hope that the corrections from later times to probes like that would be less.
One more question, Clarence.
Yeah, just let me ask if you agree with the following statement. In order to calculate V2, to really get it right, it's not sufficient to do either hydro or to do this. In fact, some calculation has to be done, which you don't even really know how to do yet.
Right. I agree. Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe one more. Dan, I think that was the last one.
Okay.
Maybe two questions in one. The first one is, there had already been some previous results in real-time dynamics on gluon fields, in particular Burns, several years back. Can you comment on whether you find the same results? I remember seeing very spiky power spectrum in some of their results, and you show a very smooth power spectrum. And the second is, you said that at late times you expect very viscous and almost turbulent hydro.
Sorry, I didn't get the...
That you expect very viscous hydrodynamics or some turbulent description, whereas Ulrich showed that almost with ideal hydrodynamics, he can reproduce the data. Can you comment on both issues there?
Okay, so let me start with the first one. I haven't compared with Berndt's calculation. I don't know if he actually computed the number distribution of gluons in his calculation. The other thing is that the two calculations are sort of different, sort of almost in principle, because we've used particular initial conditions in our approach, which I don't know if they are the same initial conditions that are used by Berndt. The other thing is that his transverse lattices are much smaller than his longitudinal lattices. So all his dynamics that he's considering is, or primarily, is longitudinal dynamics as opposed to transverse dynamics. Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, okay, but that's the difference between the two calculations. Now, to come to your second point, I would like to say that there's no system in nature which obeys ideal hydrodynamics. Okay, ideal hydrodynamics is a limit of lambda equal to zero mean free path. That is a discontinuous limit. Okay, if the limit of lambda going to zero does not commute with the limit of lambda equal to zero. So I would expect that if you have a strongly interacting system, what you would see, and this is actually seen in most sort of rapidly expanding fluids, is that you would see something more like turbulent behavior, and it would be very viscous. I would not expect such a system also to be mechanically unstable. You take most fluids and you sort of blow them apart. I mean, you know, most of what's done in ideal hydrodynamics, which I'm also guilty of the sin of having done, is that you sort of assume some sort of adiabatic expansion. You construct a Maxwell sort of adiabat. And, you know, you don't expect the system, you know, it will probably super cool. You'll form sort of bubbles or something like that. So, you know, this is sort of an idealized expression, which is the only thing one can do, and it's fine to do it. But, you know, I expect...
What does it mean that it happens because of that?
Well, you know, I think one can sort of have a press release and say, you know, we have a system in nature which obeys ideal hydrodynamics. It's the only system. Sorry? That's laminar flow, right?
Okay. So, are there any other questions?
It's also very turbulent around the wings.
Yeah. Where it
plates.
Wouldn't take off.
Right. Exactly. You need turbulence for planes to take off.